You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 118, The Hornet's Nest. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. Your contributions keep the show going. And I'd like to take the opportunity to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. The bonus episodes have been getting better and better. There's now hours of content on a huge range of Napoleonic history topics available to you for just $2 a month. And as always, you'll also get access to ad-free versions of the regular episodes. Anyway, we left off last time in late 1808. The French had just won a dramatic victory over an improvised Spanish Patriot army at the Battle of Somosierra. Although perhaps it's more accurate to say the Poles won a dramatic victory with the assistance of their French allies. In any case, after Somosierra, Napoleon's army was able to sweep down from the heights of the Sierra de Guadarrama and take its primary objective, Madrid. Napoleon had completed his plan for the second invasion of Spain in a matter of weeks. Of course, the war in Iberia was far from over. Although the Spanish capital had fallen, most of the country's territory was still free of French occupation. Spain's new provisional central government, the Supreme Junta, had fled to Seville in the south of the country, where there were no French troops within 500 kilometers, or about 300 miles. There was also still one remaining coalition field army operating on Spanish soil that had been too far away to engage in any of the fighting in this phase of the war. A force of about 40,000 mostly British troops, under 47-year-old General Sir John Moore. Moore seems to have inspired strong feelings in people. He was one of the most respected and admired officers in the British Army, but there was also a vocal minority who disliked him and considered his reputation undeserved. He had been born into a good family. His father, also named John Moore, was a prominent surgeon, and a writer and Enlightenment intellectual of some note. It was a whole family of high achievers. John Moore Sr. also had a son in the Navy who rose to the rank of admiral, and two other sons who became prominent doctors in their own right. That should tell you something about the environment General Moore was raised in, and the type of man he became. He was the ideal Enlightenment gentleman, refined, cultured, and capable of intelligent conversation on a million different topics. His energy and work ethic were almost reminiscent of Napoleon. He was also an outspoken liberal, who even served as a member of Parliament for the Whig Party. Within the military, Moore was an enthusiastic reader of modern military theory and advocated reforms to training and organization and the adoption of new doctrines. By 1808, he had also seen combat all over the world: America, Ireland, Corsica, Holland, and Egypt. He had been wounded in action 3 times. However, he was pushing 50 years old and still had never won a major victory in independent command. This was really not his fault. We've talked in past episodes about the frustration among the British officer corps, many of whom had never gotten a good chance to prove themselves on the battlefield, despite the fact that their country had been at war with France for well over a decade. But still, it was an inconvenient fact for a man who enjoyed a reputation as a great commander. To his admirers, Moore was a model officer, an intelligent and humane person who had put his considerable talents to good use in service of his country. To his detractors, he was a self-righteous, arrogant loudmouth, whose only real skill was his ability to convince other people of his talents and virtues. Moore's critics could be found at the very highest levels of the British government. In fact, the only reason he was now in command of this army was that the government's first two choices, Generals Burrard and Dalrymple, had been recalled to England to face a parliamentary inquiry over their mishandling of the Convention of Cintra. Moore's detractors were mostly put off by his assertive, do-gooder personality, but there were also concerns about his abilities as a battlefield commander. History is full of generals who were well-versed in military theory and skilled at training, organizing, and supplying an army, but incapable when it came to actually managing a campaign in the field and leading troops in battle. Was Moore one of them? As French forces pushed deeper into central Spain, the answer to that question might soon be revealed. I don't want to give you the impression there was something wrong with Moore. His reputation was generally good. The detractors were in the minority. But the fact was, despite his good reputation, high rank, a knighthood, and decades of experience, Moore still lacked a big, marquee military achievement he could truly call his own. As Bonaparte made his final push on Madrid, Moore had actually been planning an offensive of his own. It was obvious to anyone that Napoleon was aiming for the capital. Moore believed there might be an opportunity to hit his right flank as he advanced on the city, perhaps buying time for the Spanish to organize another desperate defense. Fortunately for the British, Spanish partisans were able to provide some better intelligence before Moore was fully committed to this plan. Moore's army only had about 40,000 men, and was still waiting on some of its artillery to complete the difficult march from Portugal. Napoleon already had over 50,000 men in the area, with thousands more nearby. Moore and his army had to retreat. The question was, where? There were two obvious options, the west and the south. The road west would take the army back the way they came, towards their bases of operations in Portugal, where they might link up with other British units already landing in the country and could be easily supplied by the Royal Navy. To the south, they would find the Supreme Junta and the remnants of the Patriot field armies. This would obviously be the focal point of the next phase of Spanish resistance. Moore and his army had been sent to Spain to aid the Patriots. The south would be the best place to do that. But General Moore didn't like either one of these options. His army was very close to the French. His advance units were already skirmishing with Napoleon's troops. If he fell back with his inferior force, the enemy would probably follow. In the wake of their defeats in October and November, coalition forces in Iberia were very weak. Until the Spanish and the Portuguese could raise new armies, or the British could bring in tens of thousands of reinforcements by sea, the Allies lacked the means to oppose Bonaparte on the battlefield. In this state of affairs, the last thing they needed was Moore luring the bulk of the French forces into Portugal or southern Spain. If the coalition hoped to regain its footing in Iberia, they would need those regions as recruiting grounds and bases of operations. And so, Moore decided on a much more dangerous course of action. He would lead the army northwest, towards the province of Galicia. Not only would this divert the French from more strategically important objectives, it would draw them right into some of the roughest terrain in Iberia, just as winter was setting in. Of course, this idea had one big drawback. The British army would have to face those same conditions. We've already seen many times in past episodes how badly a Napoleonic army could suffer in tough winter weather, with poor logistics and limited foraging. Think back to the campaign in Poland a few years earlier, or Junot's march into Portugal. Moving into Galicia was probably the right choice, but it can't have been an easy one. Nonetheless, Moore ordered his officers to begin preparations for a retreat to the port city of La Coruña, on Spain's very northwestern tip. He must have known he was ordering hundreds or even thousands of his men to die. They were being sacrificed in the name of the greater victory, just as surely as if they'd been ordered to make a desperate rearguard or a suicidal attack on the battlefield. When Moore gathered his officers to give them their orders, their disapproval was immediately obvious. retreating without even fighting a battle? What about British honor? Grumbles and whispers briefly filled the air, but Sir John cut them short. Quote, I have not called you together to request your counsel or to induce you to commit yourselves by giving any opinion on the subject. I take the responsibility entirely upon myself. I only require that you immediately prepare for carrying it into effect. End quote. He was right. The officers had forgotten themselves. They dutifully shut up and began making their preparations. However, this was not the end of it. Bad intelligence led to Moore canceling the retreat and going back on the offensive, only to discover his mistake and order the army to fall back towards Galicia once again. By the time the British finally got moving in earnest, it was late December. The temperature had dropped precipitously. It was raining in the lowlands and snowing in the highlands. There were cavalry skirmishes as French horsemen tried to harass the British, hoping to slow Moore down. Their British counterparts fought to screen the army from these attacks. The French cavalry had an edge in experience. They also had better horses, and their leadership is generally considered better. However, the British acquitted themselves very well in these actions, and were generally successful in keeping Napoleon's horsemen at bay. The British cavalry were led by General Lord Henry Paget, 1st Marquess of Anglesey, who was probably better known to fans of Napoleonic history by a title he acquired later in life, the Earl of Uxbridge, under which he would play a major role at the Battle of Waterloo. Early on Christmas Eve, 1808, Moore received intelligence from his Spanish allies that confirmed the plan was working. Napoleon had left Madrid with 40,000 soldiers, aiming to lead the pursuit of the British army himself. Moore wrote to a Spanish general, quote, My movement has, in some degree, answered its object, as it has drawn the enemy from other projects, and will give the South more time to prepare. With such a force as mine, I can pretend to do no more. End quote. Privately, Moore was much more pessimistic, writing, quote, I am in the hornet's nest, and God knows how I shall get out of it. End quote. By this point, Bonaparte was only about 60 miles away. That's just shy of 100 kilometers. However, the British got some good luck. A blizzard hit the Sierra de Guadarrama just as the French were crossing, causing casualties and confusion, and forcing Napoleon to spend Christmas Day resting and reorganizing his men. I wonder how many of these unfortunate soldiers had spent Christmas 1806 in similar straits, chasing the Russians through Poland. On the British side, rifleman Benjamin Harris of the 95th Rifles would later recall, quote, Some of the men near me suddenly recollected, as they saw the snow lying thickly in our path, that this was Christmas Eve. The recollection soon spread amongst the men, and many talked of home and scenes upon that night in other days in Old England, shedding tears as they spoke of the relatives and friends never to be seen by them again. As the night approached, we became less talkative. The increasing weariness of our limbs kept our tongues quieter, and we were many of us half asleep as we walked. End quote. Even high-ranking aristocrats were suffering. General Sir John Slade, commonly known by his excellent nickname Blackjack Slade, would later recall, quote, How very different was the treatment to that which we received on advancing. No more ringing of bells. No longer did the air resound with Long live the good English. All the shops were shut, and not anything to be got for love nor money. I may truly say it was the most unpleasant Christmas Day I ever passed. End quote. And it should be noted, comparatively speaking, this was the easy part of the retreat. Things would only get worse as the troops ate more of their supplies, the elevation rose, and the temperature dropped. Already on the second day of the retreat, men were falling out of their march columns, too exhausted to continue. As if their situation wasn't already bad enough, soldiers began falling ill with typhus, a deadly, debilitating disease spread by lice and fleas. Rifleman Benjamin Harris described going to sleep at night with his legs throbbing and his feet bleeding. December 26th saw the first confirmed reports of looting by British soldiers. They were not motivated by greed, but by hunger. They had not been issued rations. Already, only a few days into the march, the army's supply system was falling apart. And things would just keep getting worse. This would have been a grueling march with proper food and supplies. The British had to climb mountains and wade across rivers with freezing water up to their chests. The only consolation was, wherever they went, the French had to follow. It was a race through some of the most punishing terrain in Europe. Men on both sides often woke up before dawn and kept marching long after sunset. At one point, Napoleon sent a unit of the chasseurs of the Imperial Guard forward after the British. They returned after only a short time, reporting that the conditions were too treacherous. Napoleon ordered them to try again. This time, he accompanied them himself. He wanted to show his men he would not order them to do anything he himself was not willing to endure. The cavalry were all important in this contest. If the French horsemen could get ahead of Moore's army and slow them down, the main body of the French force might catch up to them from the rear. Moore would have no choice but to try to fight his way out with an inferior force, or surrender. The fate of the British depended almost entirely on their cavalry. If they could maintain the screen around the army and prevent their French counterparts from getting too close, they stood a good chance of making it to Galicia. If not, the likeliest outcomes were death and disgrace. A lot of responsibility had been thrust on the shoulders of a group of only about 2,000 men, many of whom were seeing combat for the first time. But amazingly, they rose to the challenge. In almost every cavalry skirmish during the retreat, the British came out on top. Some of this success can probably be credited to their commander, General Paget, who some historians have called the best British cavalry commander of the war. Still, the army was suffering terribly. The difficulty of the march could be traced by the debris on the side of the road. After a few days, abandoned equipment became a regular sight. Then, stragglers, lying in the snow, too tired to continue with their regiments, but still hoping to catch up after some much-needed rest. After a few weeks, dead horses began to appear on the roadside. Then, dead men. A British officer would write, quote, "The heavy rains have swollen and burst many of the carcasses, and the infected air hovers so rancorously above our heads, it is almost impossible to pass in any direction without feeling violent contractions of the stomach." End quote. Thanks to the army's still ongoing supply problems, at least their stomachs were mostly empty. Perhaps unsurprisingly, under these circumstances, discipline began to break down. When the army reached the town of Astorga on New Year's Eve, the troops began ransacking houses and businesses, looking for food and alcohol. Unfortunately for everyone, they found Astorga well stocked with wine, and soon many were drunk. Officers lost control, and the scene began to take on characteristics of a riot. Windows were smashed, and anything that wasn't nailed down was stolen. There were nowhere near enough buildings in this little town to house so many men. Soon, drunken British and Spanish soldiers were fighting over the prime sleeping spots. Thanks to stress and alcohol, these arguments quickly devolved into a general brawl between the British and Spanish contingents. Sadly, this incident was only the beginning. In retrospect, the riot at Astorga was the moment the dam burst. Discipline would never be fully restored for the duration of the British retreat. Officers did their best to keep a lid on things, but from this point onward, historians describe General Moore's army as more like a mob or a barbarian horde. They kept up the march. None of them wanted to be killed or captured by the French, but they did so on their own terms. They flouted the authority of their officers, looted, stole, and abused local civilians as they saw fit. Fortunately for the British, the disorder was mostly confined to the infantry. General Paget's cavalry maintained their discipline and continued holding off the French. They even managed to capture a high-profile prisoner, General Charles Lefebvre Desnouettes, who we last saw leading the initial assault on Saragossa during that city's epic siege. The French forces held together a bit better. They were experiencing the same rough terrain and punishing winter weather conditions, but their supply lines were better, they had more experience, and a pursuing army almost always has a morale advantage over a retreating army. However, there are reports of discontent within the imperial ranks as well. According to one story, a group of exhausted French infantrymen spotted Napoleon riding by on a gun carriage and began crying out, quote, "Convicts suffer less than we do. Shoot him down, damn him," end quote. Back in the British ranks, General Moore was deeply distressed by the disorder within his army. Remember, Moore had a liberal and humanitarian outlook. He was also a patriot who believed a good soldier should serve selflessly. Pillaging and abuses against civilians stirred his conscience. This disorder also presented a practical problem. If the British were going to prevail in Iberia, they would need the support of the Spanish and Portuguese people. That support had already been of great use, but it would not be forthcoming in the future if this type of behavior continued. Moore decided the problem was serious enough to delay the march so he could deliver a speech. One note before we begin, Moore referred to himself in the third person as the commander of the forces. Anyway, from his speech, quote, "The present is a moment when the army is necessarily called upon to make great efforts and to submit to privations, the bearing cheerfully with which is a quality no less estimable than valor. The goodwill of the inhabitants will be particularly useful to the army, and can only be obtained by good conduct on the part of the troops. The commander of the forces cannot impress too strongly on the whole army the necessity of this, and he trusts that the generals and the commanding officers will adopt such measures, both on the march and in camp, as will ensure it. It is very probable that the army will shortly have to meet with the enemy, and the commander of the forces has no doubt that they will eagerly imitate the worthy example which has been set by the cavalry." End quote. Under the circumstances, perhaps Moore was wise to remind the British soldiers that they needed the Spanish people, rather than trying to appeal to the better angels of their nature. Moore was even more scathing in his instructions to his army's officers. Quote, "The commander of the forces has observed with concern the extreme bad conduct of the troops at a moment when they are about to come into contact with the enemy, and when the greatest regularity and best conduct are the most requisite. The behavior of the troops in the column which marched by Valderas to this place exceeds what he could have believed of British soldiers. It is disgraceful to the officers, as it strongly marks their negligence and inattention." End quote. I think that last sentence might provide a hint as to why some people disliked Moore. He was absolutely right, but people generally do not enjoy being addressed quite so bluntly. This cannot have been how Sir John had imagined his first major campaign in independent command, leading an unruly band of marauders on a hellish retreat without even having fought a single battle. Meanwhile, Bonaparte actually seemed energized. Despite the horrible conditions and repeated setbacks at the hands of Paget's cavalry, he was sure an important victory was close at hand. As we've discussed in past episodes, the Emperor had no great love for the British, to put it mildly. He saw Britain as France's primary enemy, the source of all his problems. With only one brief interruption, the two countries had been at war for 16 years. And yet, Napoleon had never faced the Redcoats on the battlefield. He must have been relishing the chance to, at long last, personally strike a blow against the country he saw as France's archenemy. But, as always, Bonaparte's attention was divided. He had one eye on Moore, but the other was busy with reports from elsewhere. France's domestic politics, the wider geopolitical scene, and the strategic picture in other parts of the empire. That last topic was beginning to loom larger and larger. As we've discussed in past episodes, the Habsburgs had been making aggressive moves along their borders with the French Empire. By now, this had been going on for months. The situation was uncertain. No one in France could say if this was merely saber-rattling in a bid to distract Napoleon while he was busy in Spain, or if these were genuine preparations for war. But the longer this continued, the likelier it was that conflict really was on the horizon in Central Europe. By late December, tensions had risen so high that Josephine sent Napoleon a letter, warning him that people in Paris were worried about the Austrians, and asking if he would return to the capital to organize a defense against a potential invasion. Napoleon reassured her, quote, "I perceive, dear friend, that you are worried, that you are in a state of black anxiety. Austria will not make war on me. If she does, I have 150,000 men in Germany, and as many on the Rhine, and 400,000 Germans with whom to reply. Russia will not leave my side. People are mad in Paris. All is going perfectly well. I shall be in Paris the moment I think it necessary." End quote. However, as he chased more, ominous reports kept rolling in from Germany and northern Italy. The emperor was growing more and more concerned. Only 8 days after writing that letter to Josephine, Napoleon would be on the road back to France to prepare his forces in Central Europe for a campaign against the Habsburgs. It would be nearly 7 years before he got another opportunity for a showdown with a British army. It would take place under very different circumstances at a place just north of Brussels called Waterloo. Before we depart from Spain, I'd like to discuss an important aspect of the war in Iberia that we have touched on briefly a few times, but haven't really explored in depth. I think it's easiest to start with a few examples. Some of these are pretty graphic, so if any of you are sensitive to descriptions of violence, now would be the time to skip ahead about 2 minutes. Andrzej Niegalewski, a Polish officer who helped lead the charge at Somosierra, would later recall how the Spanish, quote, "cut off noses, ears, or the tongues of their prisoners, and sometimes sawed them in two between planks. On our way to Somosierra, at the edge of every road, there were Spaniards or Frenchmen hanging from every tree." End quote. A French cavalry captain recorded a particularly gruesome sight. Quote, "An officer of dragoons, nailed to a barn door, with evidence of the mutilation he had just suffered placed between his teeth." End quote. There are almost endless stories like these. It's repugnant to read about this type of violence, but when you hear from the people who carried it out, it becomes slightly more understandable. One Spaniard who had participated in similar attacks against the French explained, quote, "My father was led out and shot in the marketplace of my native village. Our cottage was burned, my mother died of grief, and my wife, who was violated by the enemy, fled to me and died in my arms, in a hospital in Saragossa. I have sworn never to dress a vine or plow a field until the enemy is driven out of Spain." End quote. These are scenes from what the Spanish would come to call the guerrilla, literally meaning the little war. This Spanish term, guerrilla, describes the parts of the conflict that took part away from the battlefields and armies. What we might call popular resistance, irregular warfare, partisan warfare, or guerrilla warfare. In fact, the word guerrilla entered English during this period as a result of British involvement in the Peninsular War. We actually use it slightly incorrectly. The Spanish guerrilla only refers to the concept itself. A person who fights in the guerrilla is properly called a guerrillero. You can blame Sir Arthur Wellesley, later Duke of Wellington, for the confusion. Among several other achievements, he was the first person to ever use this word in English. So, although it is technically wrong in Spanish, I will be sticking to the traditional English usage in this episode, referring to the people who fought in the guerrilla war as guerrillas. We'll be mostly focusing on Spain in this section. The Spanish were generally closer to the front lines of the Peninsular War, and more of their country was under occupation for longer periods of time than the Portuguese. But there were Portuguese guerrillas as well, and a lot of this applies to them too. In a certain sense, the Spanish guerrilla war is nothing we haven't seen before. Popular resistance to the French government has been a part of this story since our very early episodes. In fact, the first people we saw resisting the French with irregular, asymmetrical warfare were the French, the counter-revolutionary partisans of the 1790s, often called Chouans, who rose up against the Republic, most famously in the Vendée. Southern Italy was also notorious for partisan activity. We touched on this a bit in our episodes on Horatio Nelson. As I mentioned back in episode 108, there were so many regions within the empire with heavy partisan activity that there was actually a slang term for them within the French military. They were called Little Vendées. It wasn't only the French who provoked this type of response. During the Great Irish Rebellion of 1798, Irish patriots used similar methods against the British, and the Russians had gotten a taste of this style of warfare in Poland. So these Spanish and Portuguese guerrillas were actually just the latest in a long list of people who had opposed their occupiers with irregular warfare. But over the course of the war in Iberia, partisan activity would rise to a scale and ferocity not seen anywhere else on the continent. Some historians classify this as a national uprising rather than partisan warfare. How many guerrillas were actually operating in Spain over the course of the war is very much an open question. I've seen low estimates of 35,000, but others put the number much higher. We've seen in past episodes that historians sometimes struggle to estimate the numbers of regular troops in the field during this period, making these types of judgments about irregular troops, who definitely did not keep paper records, is almost impossible. So, who were the guerrillas? It's hard to generalize. They came from every walk of life. Most were peasants, because most people in Spain were peasants. But you could also find townspeople, members of the small Spanish middle class, and even aristocrats. Some were soldiers or militiamen. How many times over the past few episodes have we seen Spanish armies scattered and overrun by the French? Some of the survivors of these battles retreated with their units. Others were killed or captured in the chaotic aftermath. Some found their way back home. But some kept up the fight as partisans. There were often women among the guerrillas. They typically took on supporting roles while the men did the fighting. But there are also reports of female guerrillas bearing arms against French troops. From what we can tell, the vast majority of guerrilla bands were composed of average people from the local area. Their knowledge of the terrain allowed them to hide from French patrols and pick the most advantageous positions for ambushes and reconnaissance. Few had any significant pre-existing combat experience. However, the nature of rural Spanish life had given many of them tools that were very useful in irregular warfare. Some had been members of one or more of those various militia institutions we discussed back in episode 113, which provided at least rudimentary military training. At the very least, almost all had learned to shoot by hunting for game. For some guerrillas, this was not the first time they had found themselves dodging the law. Smuggling was absolutely endemic in pre-war Spain. As with many old regime countries, Spain had all kinds of internal customs barriers. There was also a very lucrative, but protected, market in France, just across the Pyrenees. Many rural Spaniards supplemented their income by defying the customs men and trading on the black market. People who had been involved in this business knew how to conceal themselves, where to hide from mounted patrols, and where and how to travel if you wanted to avoid being seen. Many who joined the guerrillas were already acquainted with interpersonal violence. The traditions of rural Spain in this period were not unlike those we saw in Corsica in our early episodes. This was an honor culture. Honor had to be defended, and there were occasions when a person would be expected to do so with force, sometimes deadly force. This was seen as a duty, almost as sacred as a religious obligation. Just like the Corsicans, Spanish men outside major cities often carried weapons, even in peacetime. A small knife, called a cuchillo, was the most typical, but it would not be unusual to see a small sword at someone's side, a pistol tucked into a sash or belt, or even a musket or carbine slung over the shoulder. These weapons were not only for affairs of honor. Rural Spain had been a dangerous place long before the French arrived. The combination of rough terrain, poor infrastructure, and weak government made it a perfect haven for bandits. Honest people needed to carry weapons to defend themselves. Less honest people needed them in case they encountered an opportunity to do a little light banditry on the side without getting caught. Spanish guerrillas are often depicted using relatively primitive weapons, hunting rifles, shotguns, swords, the ubiquitous cuchillo knife, or even farm implements. The truth is somewhat less romantic. Like many war zones throughout history, Iberia in this period was flooded with military-grade weapons. It was not hard to get your hands on a proper army-issue musket. The vast majority of Spanish partisans were armed with the same types of muskets used by regular troops, either pre-war Spanish army guns or captured French weapons, with a minority equipped with Brown Bess muskets provided by their British allies. Most fought and moved on foot, although there were a small number of guerrilla bands who used horses. Contrary to the popular image, a few guerrilla bands wore uniforms. Usually these were groups composed of ex-soldiers, or operating in areas where they could easily be supplied by the Spanish government or the British. But these were the exceptions. The average Spanish guerrilla looked mostly like the average Spanish peasant, wearing some combination of wool, usually dyed brown, and leather. This monochromatic brown look might not have been the most eye-catching ensemble, but guerrillas don't want to stand out. Some groups wore an identifying mark on their civilian clothes. For instance, there was a band led by a Catholic priest, convinced he was waging a holy crusade. They sewed red crosses onto their cloaks. Some guerrillas actually wore pieces of captured French uniforms. There was a famous guerrilla leader named Julián Sánchez García, nicknamed El Charro, meaning roughly the cowboy, who wore a French hussar's chapeau on his head, with the imperial eagle insignia turned upside down, to indicate his contempt for Napoleon. Another guerrilla chief, Juan Martín Díez, nicknamed the Undaunted, wore the full uniform of a French war commissioner. This was a high-ranking administrative position within the army bureaucracy. There were not very many war commissioners, and they were usually nowhere close to the front lines. By wearing this uniform, Díez was bragging that he and his men were capable of getting to anyone associated with the French army, even the senior pencil pushers at army headquarters. Those colorful nicknames may have jumped out at you. The cowboy, the undaunted. Almost every prominent guerrilla used this type of nickname, or as they are properly termed, a nom de guerre. Building and maintaining one's reputation was a big part of being a guerrilla leader. These colorful names helped them do that, and helped them stay anonymous. There was a chief called the Friar, and two different bands were led by men called the Priest. Those names were not figurative, they actually were Catholic priests. You might think a religion based around the teachings of a pacifist, who the Bible calls the Prince of Peace and the Lamb of God, might take a dim view of bushwhacking, torture, and assassination. But this is actually not without precedent. Catholic clergymen had been directly involved in fighting for the counter-revolutionary cause in France and Italy in the 1790s, against the British in Ireland in 1798, and against the Russians in Poland. The church hierarchy did not officially sanction this kind of behavior, but there were a lot of things about the everyday practice of European Catholicism that weren't sanctioned by the church hierarchy. Other guerrilla leaders also took nicknames from their pre-war professions. You can probably guess what the shepherd, the tanner, and the doctor were up to before the French invasion. The man they called the student was not actually a student, but a practicing lawyer. The guerrilla chief Juan Diaz Porlier was nicknamed the Little Marquis because he was the nephew of the famous military officer, the Marquis of La Romana. Others took their names from personal characteristics. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the chief they called One Hand was missing a hand. The chief known as the Waistcoat always wore a gentleman's waistcoat. The man known as the Generalissimo must have had a flair for the dramatic. I wouldn't venture to guess how the snail got his name. It seems to suggest he was slow or lazy, but I can't imagine a slow or lazy person dodging the French patrols for 4 years. As you can see from the nicknames alone, the leadership of the guerrilla movement completely ran the gamut. Some had been important people in their own right before the war. Some had been nobodies. Some had advanced degrees from good universities. Some were illiterate. There were several who didn't even speak a word of the official dialect of Castilian Spanish, used by the government and in high society, only regional languages like Basque or Catalan. If they'd ever had the opportunity to meet the exiled King Ferdinand, in whose name they fought, they would have needed a translator. We can't even generalize much about their politics. As you might expect, of people fighting for their king and faith, many were conservatives or reactionaries. But many rural Spaniards were not particularly politically conscious, and were motivated to join the movement by more personal reasons. There were also many liberals. Several of the most famous guerrilla leaders would ultimately meet their end fighting against King Ferdinand. They took up arms against him after the Napoleonic Wars, when he embraced reactionary absolutism and trashed the Spanish Constitution. The guerrilla bands were more or less self-organized, self-funded, and self-equipped, a good fit for a country whose improvised provisional government struggled to pay, organize, or outfit its soldiers. But the juntas were aware of the guerrilla movement from almost the very beginning. They sought to foster and protect the guerrillas, and to coordinate their little war with the wider Spanish war effort. First, the Supreme Junta ordered the formation of a new militia institution called the Partidas. The guerrilla bands were retroactively declared members of this organization. In theory, this official sanction from the government gave the guerrillas legal protection as lawful combatants, so that when their members were captured, they would be treated as prisoners of war, not summarily executed as bandits or rebels. It was a good idea, and well-intentioned, but as you can probably guess, the French did not play along. Captured guerrillas were dealt with incredibly harshly. Many French soldiers and even officers despised the guerrillas and took revenge on them at any opportunity. There was also a largely misguided idea of deterrence, that making a severe example of captured guerrillas would convince other Spanish civilians in the area that helping or joining the guerrillas was not worth the risk. Of course, as in most insurgencies, harsh reprisals tended to have the opposite effect. The juntas also formally called on people behind the lines to join the guerrillas, and gave their blessings to partisan attacks on the French military. From an official government declaration, quote, "All inhabitants of the provinces occupied by the French troops, who are capable of bearing arms, are authorized to arm themselves, even with prohibited weapons, to attack and loot the French soldiers on all favorable occasions, either individually or in groups, to take the food and supplies intended for their use. In a word, to cause them as much harm and damage as possible. End quote. The junta officially classified the guerrillas as land corsairs. We discussed the corsairs in episode 97. They were privateers, essentially legal pirates. Civilian mariners granted a government license to prey on enemy shipping during wartime. Unlike sailors and officers in the Navy, the corsairs were not paid by the government, but were allowed to keep a large portion of their spoils as compensation for their service. That phrase, land corsairs, is a bit awkward, but it is actually not a bad description of how the guerrillas functioned. They operated on the same principle, no pay, and little to no direct government support, but the right to keep what they took from the enemy. And more than that, there was something of the spirit of a pirate crew among the average guerrilla band. Compared to an army unit, a band was very egalitarian. The chief was more of a first among equals than a military commander. He was expected to do the same work as his men, face the same dangers and hardships, and share equally in the rewards of victory. Leaders tended to rise up organically. The guerrillas would naturally defer to the most charismatic, most respected, or cleverest among them, and he would step into the role of leader. Members of a band were allowed to come and go as they pleased. The life of a guerrilla was difficult and dangerous, but not without its charms. These were tight-knit groups, made up of people from the same area or from the same army unit. In many cases, they would have known the other members of the band since childhood. There were often family connections as well. Some bands were not much more than extended family networks. This is a big reason the French had a very difficult time infiltrating the movement. It's very hard to plant a mole in a group where everyone knows each other intimately. Descriptions of guerrilla camps often make them sound surprisingly pleasant. Plenty of stolen food to eat and wine to drink, cigars or cigarettes for everyone who wanted them, and guitar music every night. The smokes and guitars might sound like a pretty typical camping scene, but both were more or less particular to Spain at this time in history. The rest of Europe generally smoked tobacco out of pipes or not at all, and most Europeans had never heard a guitar. These were the types of exotic details that made the guerrillas romantic heroes in places like Britain and Germany. It should be said that the bounty at the average guerrilla camp was not entirely gained through the war against the French. Many guerrilla bands requisitioned food and supplies from the local peasants when they had to, just like regular soldiers. Some even took part in banditry when times were lean. It's very easy to get caught up in the romantic image of the guerrillas, freedom-loving rogues dodging the law like bandits in the Wild West. But there was also a very ugly side to their story. Their struggle against the French was brutal, even by the standards of an era largely defined by warfare. The guerrillas were specialists in spectacular violence. And I mean spectacular in the literal sense of the word. They didn't just want to kill French soldiers, they wanted to make spectacles of their victims, do things to them that other French soldiers would whisper about with dread around their campfires. At the beginning of this segment, I quoted from a French captain who described finding one of his fellow officers nailed to a barn door with evidence of the mutilation he had just suffered placed between his teeth. I don't want to get too gory here, but in case that wasn't clear, a very sensitive part of the man's body had been removed with a knife and then shoved into his mouth. This was not an isolated occurrence. This particular mutilation became something of a signature of the guerrillas. It was often done while the victim was still alive. We've talked in this episode about how guerrilla leaders sought to build their reputations. An important part of any chief's image was his ability to dole out this type of brutal violence. Some of the motivation here was revenge against the people who were despoiling Spain, but there was more going on here. This was psychological warfare. The guerrillas wanted to destroy the morale of the imperial forces, make every one of Napoleon's soldiers dread crossing the Pyrenees. The guerrillas' methods may have been crude, but they were effective. Spain was by far the least desired assignment within the French army. French General Mathieu Dumas would later describe his time in the country. Quote, "I will always remember how I was afflicted with great anxieties. Every day saw the murder of several Frenchmen, and I traveled over this assassin's countryside as warily as if it were a volcano." End quote. Many French memoirs describe an eerie feeling of always being watched the entire time they were in Spain. This is exactly what the guerrillas were trying to achieve. Every French soldier spent every waking moment looking over his shoulder. The guerrillas' fearsome reputation persisted, even when there were none around. A British soldier who spent time with the guerrillas would later recall, quote, "In the evenings, the ferocious mountaineers were joined by a number of females, their sweethearts and wives. Elated with the day's success, they made merry with drinking wine and dancing to the music of several guitars. During this merriment, both men and women frequently taunted their wretched prisoners, recapitulating the wrongs the Spaniards had suffered at the hands of the French. Having thus excited the passions to a partial state of frenzy, a signal was given by one of their number, and they rushed in among their hapless prisoners and commenced a general massacre. As they gave each blow, they drowned out the cries and supplications for mercy of their victims by enumerating the different losses each had sustained in his family during the war. Take that for my father you shot, that for my son, this for my brother, etc., until the work of death was complete." End quote. That last part is also important to note when we talk about the violence of the guerrillas. They did not create this state of affairs. They were merely responding to a situation created by Napoleon's unprovoked invasion. Many guerrillas had lost friends or family members to the French, either in official reprisal attacks or in the types of unofficial violent encounters that always occurred whenever an army of this era passed through a restive countryside. The French sowed a lot of death and misery in Spain. The more they killed and destroyed, the more people were inspired to join the guerrillas. The worse the guerrilla problem got, the more desperate or vengeful French officers resorted to brutality, and the cycle continued. Of course, not every member of a guerrilla band had lost someone to the French. Some joined up out of simple patriotism or loyalty to the king. Some were angry about government policy imposed by the French, in particular high taxes and the abolition of old feudal privileges called fueros. Interestingly, some scholars point to that honor culture we discussed earlier in the episode as a motivator for the guerrillas. This was something deeper and older than patriotism. Some in rural Spain perceived the French military presence as an insult to their honor. Their fellow countrymen were being killed and assaulted. Property was being stolen and destroyed. Foreigners, who had no right to be there, were lording over the common people. What kind of Spaniard could sit idle while such things took place? How could you call yourself a person of honor if you accepted these grave insults without seeking retribution? So the thinking went. So, once people did take up arms, what did they actually do with them? Well, despite the romantic image of the guerrillas, a lot of their actions were not very exciting. In fact, if a partisan is doing his job right, his life is pretty boring. A good guerrilla's primary mission is simply staying alive to carry on the struggle another day. They generally only engaged the enemy with overwhelming force, typically with the element of surprise. And so, the average guerrilla action was often pretty anticlimactic. Ambushes on couriers or supply convoys that would be over in only a few minutes if the partisans had played their cards right. Or a surprise attack on a small garrison or patrol, only undertaken when their guard was down. Many of the most valuable contributions of the guerrillas didn't involve fighting at all, but gathering intelligence that was then exploited by British or Spanish regulars. After a successful action, the guerrillas did their best to hide from the inevitable French response. They might retreat together to some safe haven, typically either high in the mountains or deep in the forest, or they might disperse, scatter into the countryside, with orders to meet at a predetermined rendezvous at some specific date, once the heat had died down. They might even return to their towns and villages to hide in plain sight. A French officer who fought against the guerrillas would later explain, quote, "The least of our movements was reported to them, and the promptest and most accurate reports arrived to them, thanks to the skills of the inhabitants of the country. If we left a small garrison in a town, it was taken the next day by the guerrillas. If strong bodies of troops were sent against them, they would find no one. Following the orders of their chiefs, the guerrillas hid their arms and dispersed to meet at a completely different place. Arrived at the rendezvous, they found other weapons and caused us new damages." End quote. The French tried all kinds of anti-partisan measures in Iberia. Areas with the most guerrilla activity were placed under martial law and governed directly by French generals. A special unit of gendarmes was raised specifically to fight against irregular forces in Spain, which eventually peaked at over 6,000 men. They sent spies to infiltrate the guerrilla bands. They even tried to raise their own pro-imperial guerrillas, mostly from captured bandits, who were given the choice of fighting for Napoleon or going to the gallows. Along the major roads, where ambushes were frequent, the French built small forts called blockhouses at regular intervals. As the war dragged on, military escorts for messengers and supply convoys got bigger and bigger, until by the end of the war, they were traveling with hundreds of soldiers, a major drain on manpower. Sometimes these measures worked. The French got their man, and almost inevitably made him into a terrible example. But almost like clockwork, when one guerrilla leader fell, another rose in his place. Sometimes the French succeeded at clearing an area of guerrillas, and maintaining a big enough military presence to prevent them from reestablishing themselves. But almost inevitably, priorities would change, the troops would be pulled out, and the partisans would return. In the long term, nothing worked. One of the French generals assigned to kill or capture the infamous guerrilla chief Juan Martín Díez, nicknamed the Undaunted, would later explain, quote, "We had to search constantly for him, and to sort out the good information from the false intelligence. When I defeated him, he disappeared without a trace. No peasants were to be found anywhere, and information vanished with them. I would often run around for 8 days without seeing a single inhabitant. Consequently, there was no news nor new directions to pursue." End quote. With no intelligence and nothing to go on, the general and his men would patrol fruitlessly around the region until their food ran out, then returned to base. Incidentally, that general's name was Leopold Hugo, whose son, Victor Hugo, would go on to achieve great fame. At the peak of French anti-partisan operations, perhaps over 100,000 imperial troops were tied down, hunting or deterring the guerrillas. It must have been incredibly frustrating and frightening, fighting an unseen enemy who was always one step ahead, and who inflicted horrifying violence on one's comrades. Under the circumstances, it was probably inevitable that at least some French troops responded by lashing out against Spanish civilians, with horrifying violence of their own. Sometimes this was sanctioned from above. Many French officers believed in meeting cruelty with cruelty, and as in any war, some were simply sadistic. As it always does, violence bred more violence. There's an anecdote from later in the war that I think illustrates the horror of these types of escalations quite well. A large group of guerrillas led by Francisco Esposa Mina, nicknamed El Mozo, meaning roughly the young one, was able to besiege a smaller group of French troops led by General Louis Abbe. El Mosso wanted to intimidate the enemy, so he brought out 6 French prisoners within sight of the walls and had his men shoot them in cold blood. General Abbe decided to respond in kind. He had 6 Spanish prisoners brought up to the walls and ordered them shot. An eye for an eye. It could have ended there, but there was way too much bad blood on both sides for that to happen. Next, El Mosso brought forward 4 more French prisoners and had them brutally tortured within sight of the walls. I'll spare you the details, but suffice it to say, these men must have been screaming in agony before their suffering finally ended. As a French general, Abbe felt he could not sanction torture, but he certainly could sanction reprisal killings. In fact, they had become practically routine for French forces in Spain. He had 40 Spanish prisoners brought up to the walls and executed within sight of the guerrillas. This barbaric tit-for-tat continued until neither side had any prisoners left to kill. It's not easy to tell the story of the guerrillas. It's a story of freedom, courage, and resistance to oppression. It's also a story of sadistic massacres and torture, otherwise normal people finding themselves trapped in a never-ending cycle of unspeakable violence. While their individual actions are not very notable, the activities of the guerrillas as a whole had a huge impact on the war in Spain. I think it's safe to say they were among the deciding factors in this theater of the war. And so, as we move on with the narrative, keep it in the back of your mind. The guerrilla is always going on in the background. Napoleon would come to refer to the war in Iberia as an ulcer. Like an ulcer, it stung every day, even on days when the French armies did not suffer defeats on the battlefield. It was guerrilla warfare that made the pain so persistent. That's all for now. Before we go, I'd like to mention a book that was a huge help in writing this episode, Spanish Guerrillas in the Peninsular War by René Chartrand. If you're a Patreon subscriber, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with a new bonus episode. Make sure to get in your questions. Otherwise, we'll pick back up next month with Napoleon leaving Spain, war with Austria on the horizon, and General Moore continuing his deadly march into Galicia. Until next time, thanks for listening.